Thank you for listening, and welcome to When Pigs Fly. Talk from the heart, the mind, and the soul. And I'm your host, Andrew Fetter. Again, she's running around through the United States on her Big Fall Tour, and I'm sure you got to go hear her if wherever you're at. And I'll just give you a listing. She's been, now she's heading down south into Memphis, Tennessee. She's actually playing at the Escape Alley tonight, and you got to go see her there. And then she's heading off to Louisiana at Shreveport, Louisiana, at the Jane Murray's on the Cross Lake, and that's tomorrow. And from there, on the 24th, she's heading to Houston, Texas, to Chance's Bar, then to Austin, Texas, on the 25th, to Momo's, and then she heads back to California to a little cool little coffee shop called La Stotts in San Diego on November 3rd. And do check her out, her website at angiematson.com. She also has on there links to her site, so you can even download, listen to individual songs from her new released album, Skeleton Arm. You definitely want to check her out. And, of course, her latest was Sudden Impact, which was a nationwide hit with Drive. Now, I'm also going to play a very special next week, a special interview that I did have with her. That was from my November 13th interview with her, and that is my special prize for next week. So I just let you all know, of course, this is Andrew Fetter, and welcome to When Pigs Fly. Now, I also want to let another announcement, because I'm doing the show here in Las Vegas, Nevada, because I'm doing, of course, my signing event for my newly released book, Spirit. And, of course, you can check that out at andrewspirit.com. I am going to be in the Summerlin store of Psychic Eye Bookstore tomorrow on the 23rd at 1 p.m., and that is a 6848 West Charleston, and across the street is Rainbow in Charleston, I believe. And then on the next week, on the 30th, on the Saturday at 2 p.m., I will be at Barnes Noble 567 North Stephanie in Henderson, Nevada. So please come on down and say hello, and I look forward to speaking with you all. Now, I have a very, very special guest. I read this book that was sent to me via the publicist, Eric Von Däniken, and while I was reading it, everyone was fighting, friends of mine who were partners of mine from Australia, and we were all fighting reading this thing. Had to get it back from so I could finish reading it, and I feel really honored to have Eric Von Däniken's associate on my show, Giorgio Tsokalos, and I'm sure you've all have seen him many, many times as I have. He's a face of recognition when it deals with the understanding of extraterrestrials and UFOs, and specifically, he's basically, some people have referred to him as the Indiana Jones because of his archaeological know-how and the spans of the globe that he has traced to the connections from the ancients to our current events. So first of all, I want to welcome you, Giorgio, for coming on my show, and thank you. How are you doing today?
Very well. How about you?
Doing fantastic.
Great.
Now, I got a plethora of questions for you, because as I was reading this, it's really interesting when I was reading this book. See, I was involved with the Hopi, and while I was working with the Hopi, because I did a major documentary, which is to release next year, they got into an issue, and this is why I have to bring this up before getting into the Mayans, because the Hopi feel they're actually, the Mayan and the Aztec is of their blood. They basically believe they went four different directions. And it was real interesting that the commonalities of the stories with presented in the book, which we'll get into, of what the Mayans say about extraterrestrial events, and sort of with the Hopi, because the Hopi constantly talk about the world, the third world, the fourth world, and right now we're in their fourth world, going in the fifth world. But they talk of a person, like somebody coming back, and the description of this person is some blonde, tall person, and he had a missing piece of a stone. And when this happens, before this happens, there's a red streak that goes through the sky, and they very descriptive talk about a blue star that comes closer from the area of the Pleiades, which I don't know how the hell they know where Pleiades is. They also were well informed that there was, in fact, one of their major stories is how one time description of the Ice Age is how the axis had started shifting on Earth, which how would they know that the world is round and it's going on its axis before even Western world knew about this? Which leads me into the Mayans and what you're understanding, because this is what sort of I felt there was a very unique situation when I started reading this book and I started seeing events that they talk about, in particular of the 2012 and this the calendar, because their calendar almost relates very similar to the Mayan calendar as the way they describe their events. So this is why I got, wow, this is too much apples and apples. It's not apples and oranges here. What is your understanding and your feeling between the alien understanding of extraterrestrials and between both Mayan and Hopi?
Well, I mean, the Hopi are very clear, and so are many of the Native American myths that the origin of mankind is in direct connection with what they call the Star People. And some have even suggested, some elders, not just have suggested, but are still today suggesting that planet Earth has in fact been seeded by the Star People, and that life in general, you know, came here as a whole from outside this planet. And so in all the major ancient Native American myths, we have these stories of the so-called kachinas, and most of our listeners have seen these kachinas. If you just go to any souvenir shop in Native American land, you will find them in, you know, these nice little wood carvings of these figurines that in many cases look like they're wearing some type of animal suits and animal masks and feathers and things like this. But amongst those kachinas representations, there are also some other ones that look eerily similar to modern-day astronauts. And when you ask some of those elders, you know, who were these kachinas, without the flinching of an eye, they will tell you that the kachinas were, it's kachina basically means teachers from the sky, or teacher from the sky. Mm-hmm. And what the kachinas did is when they showed up in physical form, they taught mankind in various disciplines, such as agriculture, mathematics, astronomy, all those different things, at a time when some of this astronomical knowledge was not even known officially or, you know, corroborated by, quote-unquote, modern society. So we have multiple examples like this, not only in Native American myths, but in myths from all around the world, and it doesn't matter what culture or what continent you go to.
They're all very similar.
Yes, and the idea is that we were all visited by extraterrestrials in the remote past, and that's the basic definition.
Actually, I was going to apologize, but I was going to correct you on one thing, because the kachina actually comes from the word in Hopi, gachina, which means branch. And they have a dual meaning of kachinas. The one is what you're talking about, which is they say there's spirits out there that come around. That's the kachina. But they also represents kachina, meaning that we're all branch of the same branch. We're all sort of the same thing. We're all merging to become one people. We're really looked at one. We're not separated from each other as people think we are.
Right.
So that's what they have a dual meaning by that. But it's interesting,
sure, but
that
you're not correcting me. You're just adding to the story.
Okay, I'm sorry. But But I did know that what you're talking about is very much in depth, like you said, with their stories. In fact, the Hopi say, and this is what's come out from them, that they're originally actually one of the lost tribes of Israel or whatever, that they did come from Jerusalem. But the way they describe to me how their story, they came here, is actually an influence of the Kachinas telling them how to get here. And they talk about going from, and this, by the way, goes into Polynesian area, which is where they're from, and from China and whatnot, from what they call a China Trail. But it's very interesting because the way their description of how they came from the way of onto this fourth world is the same as how the Hawaiians and the Polynesians travel around, almost like somebody up there is directing them traffic how to get to, you know, how would you, you know, there's nothing but sea from Hawaii all the way to the coast. How would they know what area to go to? And they seem to know exactly what line and what, you know, if you're planning a course, how to get there. They said they knew where to go because of what you had just said, the Kachinas had described to them where mm-hmm. to go. So I thought that was pretty bizarre. And as far as the linking between all Native Americans, they actually, all that is merged from the Hopi. But the thing that I felt really blown away by what you're got into the book and a lot of understandings is how, and that's what I was trying to get into, because they describe a Bahana. Jews and Christians have a Messiah. Muslims have the Mahdi. And, you know, each, and then in Asia, they have there's another story of them. I think there's something about the three kings, the Tibetans or whatever. And I have a question for you on that as well from the Far East. But it seems like every culture, wherever you go, has a specific that they're coming back or somebody's coming back. And it seems too coincidental that it's all coming around a period within approximation of 100 years apart within this area of time. And it seems like from the Mayans, which I want to get into is how you got into figuring out the Mayan calendar and how you figured out that the Mayans calendar is basically, well, I don't want to tell the surprise, I'll let you just explain, is it basically the chronological events of the ETs.
Well, I mean, here's the problem today with the whole 2012 discussion, and that is, you know, the Maya never, not once, said that the world was coming to an end or that extraterrestrials will return on 2012 or the apocalypse will happen or judgment day, end of days, all this nonsense, because what they merely said was that it's the end of a period of time and a new period of time will begin. So it's basically the same thing when on the 31st of December every year, your desk calendar runs out. What do? You go to the store, you buy yourself a new one, and there you have another calendar for the following year. Now, the idea that 2012, is going to be such a doom and gloom scenario, in my opinion, is rather nonsense, because here's the problem, and that is, you know, right now, it's not 2010. Right now, because first of all, the first argument is we just went from 1 AD, from 1 BC to 1 AD. There never was a year zero. So right there, we're off by 1 year. So it's either 2009 and 2000 or 2011. And then argument number two, in the Middle Ages, and the book briefly touches about this as well, in the Middle Ages, it was the monks that were in charge to record our calendar, and some scholars in France and at Berkeley determined that somewhere some people made mistakes up to 6 years. So 6 + 1 = 7. So right now it's 2003 or it's 2017. And then the third and last argument is: do we really know 100% that our calendar began on the day when Jesus was born, when we now know he wasn't even born on the 25th of December? So we can be as far off as 300 years right now. And so, this whole 2012 discussion, it's quite unsettling because it is based on an entire fabrication. And the bottom line is that the 2012 fear is nothing else but Y2K 2.0.
So it's like the whole, everybody's all glimmery and whole, like basically the same thing. And it was, but it's interesting that you just mentioned it, because I remember with the calendar being that far off, it can, mm-hmm. the possibility of a span. You're talking almost 10 to 20 years off.
Mm-hmm.
How can anybody pinpoint a date? So my question is, then why is the significance on the Mayan calendar false for such a specific date?
It's not necessarily false. It's 100% correct, but our counting of the calendar is wrong.
Okay, I got you.
So, yeah. No. The 2012 thing, according to the Maya, that is correct. I mean, that's a correct date. But see, our counting of the calendar is wrong. It is not 2010 right now. That is what I was getting at.
Right.
However,
I get
not,
you. So it's yeah. like an app. Their number is an absolute, and ours is sort of like up. It's like somebody would call in quantum physics, it would be a wave function, an area, a probability somewhere.
Right, because we're not right now. Our year that we write today is not correct. And you know, the
right.
other fascinating thing that nobody talks about is the fact that, okay, so we know that the calendar, the Mayan calendar, ends on the 21st of December 2012. However, what nobody talks about is, well, if the calendar ends on a particular date,
uh-huh.
do we actually know when the calendar began?
Right.
And the answer is yes. There has always been a few suggestions, but today scholars kind of agree on one date, and that's the 11th of August, 3114 BC. And so we would all have to agree that the Maya really did not exist back then, archaeologically speaking. So the question is, what was so compelling for them to, you know, devise a calendar?
When was the Maya first originate, you said? Not before what time?
Well, according to the mainstream, it was, you know, 200-300 AD before they showed up, which I
wow.
disagree with. They were definitely earlier, but that's
okay.
what the official, what the mainstream says now. But the 3114 BC date, the Maya were very clear in stating that at that time, the road to the stars descended from the sky, and the 9 and 13 gods descended and taught mankind in various disciplines, and they will return one day to rectify everything.
Okay, and what period was this?
That was on the 11th of August, 3114 BC, when the Mayan calendar actually began.
Okay, so but the period that they came before to disseminate this information was during that time, you're saying? And then there, is that what you're talking about?
Sure, yes.
Okay, because I just was curious, because there was a correlation of time, and this is, of course, based on our fragmented calendar, because I thought there was a coincidence, because I saw, like, they talk about, like, Ezekiel, Buddha, Lao Tzu, and Taoism, they all came around approximately around the same time, around the 500 BC area, which I thought was pretty bizarre. So I was just curious, you know, the time period.
Well,
Maya.
there have been multiple visits. It's not just, I mean, the 500 BC thing, absolutely correct. I mean, even Ezekiel, that whole chronology falls into place with whatever Ezekiel witnessed there. But there have been multiple visits over thousands of years, and those visits, by the way, are still going on today, just not as official as they used to.
Right. Okay, I got you. So, I mean, because people are now seeing more UFO activity and things like that, which goes into my belief is just there's some people call it the click factor, and it deals with resonance with the human species or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're like, and this gets a little bit on the spiritual, but also more on quantum level. that if your frequency raises, because there's so many clicks per second, the average person sees 16 to 20 clicks. If your frequency raises, you're able to see 100. Well, if you're going further, you'll be able to perceive and see things that are a lot higher. And if you have extraterrestrials on that higher level, then you'll be able to you see that frequency, which is sort of like what happened with Columbus pulling up on a ship, where the shaman only was the only one who saw him because he was at that frequency, could see them and recognize, you know, here the Spaniards or whatever coming on the shore, and the other people didn't recognize it because they're on a different frequency. So I'm thinking now people are becoming more related. They're seeing these events happening because they're able to, you know, consciously actually recognize what was there was always there. They just couldn't see it for their own eyes. So my question is, because this is another issue, and because that's pretty interesting when you're talking with the calendar. Now, so the calendar effect that's supposed to be, we'll just call it 2012, just so everybody's happy here. The event now is that per the calendar, because this gets into an issue that I'm going to get into, the Puma, Punku, and the sun sign and all that stuff, is the, and from what I was understanding from the book, is that that was posted about on premise that they're coming back. These particular extraterrestrials are coming back, or they're more formally going to be acknowledged as being here. That's my question.
Right, and of course, I cannot give you an answer because who knows? The thing is that one thing is for sure, that absolutely extraterrestrials will return that have been here in the past, because that is exactly what they all promised. However, the extraterrestrials are already here because we see UFOs every day, and even if, let's say, 99% of all UFO sightings are from UFOs that are man-made, that, you know, because if the military releases something today, at an air show or something like this, you know that technology is 20 years old.
Right, right.
But at the same time, you know, even if the 1% is indeed extraterrestrial, then that is all we need. And it, by the way, the same counts for abductions, that, you know, if 99% of the abductions are done by human beings and then only 1% are being conducted by extraterrestrials, well, that's all we need. And so, you know, when all of this will go down, how and who will return, or who will come back, or who will publicly reveal themselves, it's anyone's guess. And anyone who will tell you they know exactly who's coming back and what their names are, run for the hills, because those are all false people who just say this stuff for their own attention.
Right. So you're basically saying on the 2012 is just a changing of a period. Of it's not necessarily that they're all hell, we're back, you know, type of thing.
No,
it's just basically we're moving into another period.
Absolutely.
So it's almost like everybody, there's a talk of a period where they're changing of, another calendar was saying, oh, we're out of the astral, and this is more astrologically, you know, we're out of the Pisces and we're moving to the age of Aquarius and all that stuff.
Yes, absolutely. And the thing is that, you know, that in that sense, you know, if you look around you, I mean, it's really interesting to see that lately there's the extraterrestrial question has been addressed on multiple media platforms. I mean, there's multiple TV shows that now talk about this, and I'm not just talking about ancient aliens, but I'm also talking about, you know, fictional stories like The Event or Fringe and things like that, which all are closely related to extraterrestrials. And then you have movies like the latest Indiana Jones movie that just came out a couple of years ago, or Race to Witch Mountain and things like that. I mean, or Skyline, which will open in a few weeks. I mean, those all have, you know, extraterrestrials at their core message. And, you know, when people ask me, well, when do you think disclosure or official disclosure will finally happen? Then, you know, all I can do is look at them and say, what are you talking about? When do I think it's happening? Look around you. Disclosure is happening right now. And the fact that the media is being used it's a stroke of genius to, you know, and also podcasts and radio shows and you know, YouTube videos and things like this
yeah.
are all part of disclosure. And so,
but I see two parts of the disclosure. I see some parts that are actually part very much positive and showing what it is, and I see others for their own agenda placing a fear factor with extraterrestrials, like the TV show V, for example. Beware,
mm-hmm.
they might be lizard people coming to get you. You know, there's you know, the War of the Worlds. I
yeah.
think there's a lot of myth
there's
being
a,
presented, and there's a lot
yeah.
of positive. There's both sides of media.
Right, and you know, and you're totally right. I mean, and I'm glad you actually bring this up, because the bottom line is that, you know, if extraterrestrials really were out there to come and eat us and, you know, have us for dessert and lunch and all that stuff, or annihilate us, that would have happened a long time ago already. You know, why wait? And so, you know, those ideas that extraterrestrials will come here to destroy us, I really think are a bit far-fetched, because, or you know, Stephen Hawking saying that we should never try to contact aliens because they
yeah,
will destroy us. I mean, you know, it's really, I mean, the discussion is really odd. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, everything is hunky-dory out there with these other civilizations, that they're all, you know, lovey-dovey with each other. You know, of course there is, you know, wars and things like that also out there, because good and evil permeates the entire universe.
Well, we're not that far up the food chain, let me put it that way. And so this brings up another thing, because what you're saying, I've heard somebody, and this is on Fox News, being actually ridiculed. I don't know who he was interviewing, I forgot.
Mm-hmm.
It was somebody talking about the disclosure just recently. They had a conference and stuff like that, and they're starting trying to make a joke out of him, like, oh, I know what it was. It was about the, you know, the disclosure of UFOs or activity within the silos and, you know, of nuclear facilities, tipped missiles and stuff like that, how they become inert, and there's a UFO happened to be there and they turned them into an obsolete weapon, you know, or whatever. And the person that would say, the commentator made this ridicule mark, like, well, if they're here, why don't they just come here and show themselves? Why this cloak and dagger type of thing? And I was thinking, well, why would they need maybe they look at us, you know, and if you look at society and the world how it is, it's a joke. It's like a prison planet. It would be like how people in our society look at, you know, gangs fighting amongst themselves. Well, how far is it from our humanity itself, fighting over statues, calling my God is better than your God still, or dividing little lines up and calling this is my turf, that's your turf. This is Mexico, this is America, or this is Lebanon, Israel, Palestine,
mm-hmm.
or you know.
No, I totally agree. And
so if they
yeah.
look down on us, they look at us being basically, you know, not far up the food chain.
Right.
So
this is a very dangerous planet, and that is why. Look, making contact, official contact, is not a right; it's a privilege.
Yeah.
And right now, we are such a dangerous planet. You know, I think that until we figure out, we've cleaned up our own house, there is no way that, you know, official contact will take place, because, you know, that is the main problem, that, you know, it's as if, I mean, have we ever attempted to come into a meaningful conversation with a pile of chickens? No, we haven't. And, you know, I sometimes look at our society as this chicken coop or this pile of chickens, that, you know, nobody in their right mind would want to hold a meaningful conversation with us, because even though all the tools that we need, you know, everything is within our hearts. We all know what's good and evil. We all know what's right and wrong. We all know what's moral and immoral. I mean, it's all there. And to proclaim that, oh, well, you know, there's extenuating circumstances where you can't always follow through, in my opinion, is baloney. So, you know, until we haven't figured that one out, I think it'll be a cold day in hell when extraterrestrials would make official contact right now.
It's sort of like that word, the term that I'm trying to reflect, the Star Trek term they used to use, non-interference of
other... the prime directive.
The prime directive, as they called it. But you know what? I think they have, there's up to a point, and this gets into, I don't want to jump into, because other stuff I want to have to ask you about,
mm-hmm.
especially about Puma Punku, and I can't pronounce it, but I have a problem with those it's like a tongue twister, Peter Piper type of thing. But my feeling is, because it gets into, I don't want to get into much, but in the nuclear issue of fission and blowing up things, it gets into creating pockets, and it gets in quantum, that we're playing with stuff that we probably don't even know of, because we don't understand dark energy and dark matter and things like that. We're actually could possibly opening up different events that we don't even realize that's on other levels, and how they possibly travel is by bending space, that we can actually be messing up systems. So we don't even know. We're like little kids with a candy that we don't even know what we have. So that was, I think, a part of the problem, and why I think there's intervention whenever there's nuclear activity. Because I'll give you an example. There was a lot of sightings right now going through Iran right now because of their attempt to possibly create a nuclear device. So I think that has something to do with it, what you're saying. But I do feel there's going to be, actually, my own personal thing, I think there is coming an intervention pretty soon, and I think it's just because it's there's a split in society, you know, and this is where, by the way, with the Ezekiel says, and this is what all the scriptures say, and they're all, whether it's from east to west in Hopi, the same as how what they call the prophecy rock, where there's they came up with the word ascension, is basically people choosing to go above and people remaining on two atmospheres. But I don't want to get into, because that's into some spiritual quantum issues. But I want to ask you the significance. This really blew me away. And I saw you on TV, and I knew, and it hit me. I was like, and then, you know, it was a thing that confirmed that there were extraterrestrials. And that's the city called Tiwanaku. Am I pronouncing it correctly? At Pumapunku. Is that correct? With the big, huge boulders that look like they're laser cut. And that sort of blew me away.
Right. I mean, there is an area in the Bolivian highlands of the Andes, on the border of Bolivia and Peru, right where Lake Titicaca is, which is the highest navigable lake in the world. And every day, many, many tourists go there to a place called Tiwanaku. And Tiwanaku is very famous because it's got a wonderful gate of the sun, and it's got a wonderful gate of the moon and a couple of statues there, and wonderfully carved and very intricate stuff. And only 150 yards away from Tiwanaku, there is another site called Pumapunku. Now, unless you ask the guide to bring you there, you will not be shown that place. Because contrary to Tiwanaku, which has many, many, many carvings, faces, flowers, and things like that, Pumapunku is a completely anonymous site. There is not one single carving there of any heads or any hieroglyphs or any type of embellishments or flowers, but instead you have these massive, massive blocks of granite stone that have been cut with such precision that if you were to apply your thumb and run it down a groove and apply just a little bit of pressure, you could cut yourself. And I have, because I've been to that place on a few occasions. And it's really amazing that these massive blocks, when you touch them, they feel like glass, which means that they had to have gone under some process called vitrification. And vitrification basically occurs when stone is heated up to such a high degree that the stone goes into its liquid state, magma. And then what you can do is, and this is being done every day by, you know, modern engineers, you can, for example, pour this liquid rock into molds and thus create prefabricated blocks. And at Pumapunku, we have about 8 of these prefabricated blocks that kind of look, they're called H-blocks because they look from the front like H-blocks or blocks that are shaped in the letters, in the letter H. And they're about 1 yard tall, one meter and 10 centimeters tall. And computer animations have shown that those blocks fit together like Legos, and they have an interlocking mechanism And it's really amazing. And there's a wonderful animatic or graphic that, or actually animation, that was made on Ancient Aliens in Season 1, Episode 1, The Evidence. And I urge everyone to go and check out that episode because it's fairly spectacular. You know, because it looks as if all these stones were either the male or the female part of, you know, interlocking other stones. And Puma Punku defies logic, and Puma Punku, in my opinion, is the most fascinating archaeological site in the world because nobody really knows what happened there.
So these rocks are not, because at first I thought they were like laser cut. So you're saying that these had to been formed, not laser cut.
Both. I'm basically suggesting both. And you know the laser cut idea is also very interesting because, you know, in that same episode, I'm actually talking to this real life stonemason, stone cutter, Roger Hopkins, and I showed him a few pictures of Puma Punku, and I said, "So Roger, could you go ahead and, you know, would you be willing to recreate this, and how long would it take you?" And now, mind you, this guy has been cutting stone and has also worked in archaeological sites in Egypt for 30 years.
Huh.
And there he is, and that's actually on tape. You can see it in the episode. He says, there is not any amount of money that you can give me that would where I would consent myself to try to recreate this. Now, who am I going to listen to? Am I going to listen to the professor who stands before a chalkboard, or am I going to listen to a stone cutter who has been cutting stone for 30 years with sophisticated technology? It's not like, you know, he's sitting there
right.
with a handsaw.
Right.
All right. So, you know, I mean, look, archaeologists, professors in front of the chalkboard, they're doing all great research. I love them. They're fantastic. But sometimes, you know, they don't make any sense because I am not negating that ancient people knew how to cut stone. Because, of course, they knew how to cut stone.
But not at that level.
Not at that
and
level.
And not that large.
Exactly.
And not that, and not making it smooth as glass.
Right. Right, because you cannot accomplish that with polishing,
But what's my question for you is the significance of when were the do they have an estimation of when this occurred?
I mean, and that's another funny story because mainstream archaeology today says that that Puma Punku was built by the Aymara Indians. And the Aymara Indians are still the same people that live there up on that highland plateau, and they're the ones, and I'm sure you've seen these pictures, and many of our
right.
listeners too, they're the ones who have these magnificent boats made out of reed and straw that are floating on Lake Titicaca. In fact, they're floating hotels. You can go there and spend a couple of days and it's usually bobbing up and down. I mean, it's just wonderful. It's amazing. I mean, I urge everyone to go do it. But here's the problem that, you know, I would suggest or I would surmise that in order to build something as magnificent as Puma Punku, you need writing. You need plans. You need blueprints. And the archaeologists, though, say themselves that the Aymara never had any writing. So right there, they're contradicting themselves. And then two, today, like I said, the heirs to the Aymara or the Aymara themselves, they're still there. So they're very adamant about their oral traditions. So when you go there, you can ask them, so what can you tell us about Puma Punku? They will tell you straight to your eye, they will say, well, you know, ever since we stumbled upon the scene, this place was already in ruins, and from what we know, this place has been here since before the beginning of time. And then when you ask them, well, who built it, they will point to the sky and say, los dioses, which means the gods. So, and why is Western society or Western science then saying, oh, no, it was built by them? I mean, you know, I'm not undermining or I'm not, you know, saying that the Aymara back then, you know, were primitive and they didn't know how to do stuff. But we're talking granite here, where the only thing that, you know, that can cut this stuff is either quartzite or anything tipped with diamonds. And today, in order to cut any type of granite, we use diamond-tipped saws.
Right, right.
You know,
and gets into that precision and everything is like it doesn't make sense. It's not
which we would have a hard time replicating today.
Yeah. So they're good. So, but what about and we can't do any really carbon dating, can we? Off that.
No, because here's the thing that yes. Carbon dating at Pumapunka Tionaku has been done, but we have to remind ourselves that carbon dating can only be done on organic material.
Right.
For example, if a bone is found there,
right.
Or coal or wood.
Yeah, well, it's stone, so we can't. So unless they have some leather or wood or something.
Well, they did, and so this is why mainstream archaeology says that Tiwanaku dates from like 300-500 AD. But, you know, that would be the same argument. So what they're saying is that because they found a fragment that they were able to carbon date to 500 AD, then the entire site was built in 500 AD and inhabited for the first time. And that is a complete false step in logic, because it would be the same thing to say that if you move into a new apartment or into your next apartment, that you are in fact the first tenant,
right.
In 99% of the cases is not true.
Right.
You know, so you know, just because the textiles and bones and stuff were found at Pumapunku that date to a certain time does not mean that Pumapunku was built, you know, only 1,500 years ago. I, in fact, think that it was built 10,000-12,000 years ago.
Now, what about how far is? I remember is the were there like the area where they have like almost like drawings on the ground that you can only see above?
Yes, that's far is, you're referring to the Nazca lines, and that's
how far is that from this area?
It's about 1,000 to 1,500 miles.
Oh, okay. So significantly far away from that.
Yeah, but if you have spaceships, it's nothing.
Oh, that's true.
Or if you have airplanes,
right,
you know?
Right.
And so those are the Nazca lines, and some actually have said that some of these Nazca lines point in direction of Lake Titicaca and thus Pumapunku and Tiwanaku.
Oh, okay. Now the Gate of the Sun... I was reading the book, also points to an aspect which also reflects to Pumapunku, that what you were in the book reflects to that as being the perspective that this was actually built by extraterrestrials. And by the way, in the book, a reference that the indigenous there had referred to that area being built in one day, I believe.
Yes, I mean, that is what the mythology says, and, you know, I personally take mythology always with a grain of salt, because, yes, look, what we're after is we're after the kernel of truth in each legend and each mythology and things like that, but, you know, I'm a nuts and bolts kind of guy, and I don't care what your technology is, you know, I really, really don't think that something like that could be created in one night. You know, I mean, unless, you know, whoever built this really had such advanced, you know, technology that it is indeed possible. But like I said, I always like to investigate stuff with things that I'm familiar with. So, you know, Pumapunku is this most amazing of archaeological places in the world where... nothing makes sense anymore because you have all the elements that you find there are perfect. I mean, mind you, you know, you go some places in the ancient world and you can see where masons made mistakes, where they, you know, chipped off something by mistake or someone, you know, error occurred. At Puma Punku, not a single error can be found. It's as if only the master builders were able to work there. And on top of that, the reason why there was no error is because, you know, the things that they used weren't handheld or, you know, man-made, but they were machine-made.
Okay, well, I got, but the question is on the gate of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
How does it reflect that that infers being that this is actually was created by extraterrestrials? Because, I mean, there was a reference to that in the book that this, that it was referring to in the gate of the sun, that from the perspectives of the book, that this was created by extraterrestrials.
Yes, and that's what I'm saying. I'm saying 100% that Puma Punku is probably the one and only monument in the world that was, in fact, not built by man, but by extraterrestrials.
Period.
Because,
and that's the description on the Gate of the Sun, basically.
Well, and the Gate of the Sun also is interesting that on the back of it, you know, you have another calendar that goes back as far as 120,000 years. I mean, it's we're 147. I forgot what the number is, but it's absolutely wild, and that calendar is essentially more sophisticated than ours, and so, you know, I mean, that in and of itself is sensational, because look, we're the first ones to say that, you know, the pyramids in Egypt were not built by aliens, because that is not what the ancient scriptures or the ancient holy books and texts of ancient Egypt are saying. The Egyptian books are saying that the pyramids were built by human beings, i.e. by the ancient Egyptians, with the help of the guardians of the sky. And who were the guardians of the sky? Well, extraterrestrials. Flesh and blood extraterrestrials who gave technology to our ancestors, who instructed them how to use technology, and our ancestors, you know, intellectually speaking, they were as smart as we are today. It was just that their technological frame of reference.
Well, that gets into
different.
The Egyptian thing gets into the idea, which I even saw you on a show do. I forgot which area it was that where the archaeologists, and this is presumed before I think they even knew there were a thing called light bulbs. And there's a description on the wall showing, they said they were lotuses or something like that.
Yes.
And then you said you couldn't light out even a match or anything there because there's no oxygen, enough oxygen down there or something like that. And it looked like, for me, if I didn't even know it, it would look like to me, it looked like just basically fluorescent light bulbs.
Yes, so, absolutely. And, you know, because, again, our ancestors...
Well, what area was that anyway? I forgot.
Well, the light bulb crypt can be found at Dendera.
Okay.
And that is in the Luxor region of Egypt. And, you know, it's fascinating that this one engineer in Austria, he just recently died, unfortunately. His name was Dr. Walter Garn. He actually recreated this lamp, and it works. It's fascinating, and, you know, again, why on earth would our ancestors go through all this sweat and blood and carve, as one professor says, a giant eggplant and then worship that eggplant? I mean, who is insulting whom here? You
right.
See, to suggest that our ancestors were so stupid to worship eggplants.
Well,
I mean,
this goes in the issue. It keeps on going because there's in person. I think there's a cross between the Israelites and the Egyptians because of technology. And you brought up in the book. Well, it's brought up in the book about the ark as well, the Hebrew
mm-hmm.
ark, and how the covenant ark had it was almost like a communication device.
Yeah,
I'm not sure, but I believe I'm trying to remember what it was. I was trying to look it up. I recall that some people, some kids or students or professors tried to recreate it based upon it, and almost got electrocuted trying to do that. So, in fact, the way it was designed basically as a communication device as opposed to. And then there's a story where I know if you read the Bible, it even says how somebody touched it, did it the wrong way and got electrocuted. Basically, if you read the description, one of the priests. The one, the Cohens, the sons of, I believe, of Aaron, I can't remember right now,
Yeah,
and they got basically electrocuted.
Yeah,
so they
smitten
have...
to death. And the thing is that, you know, also after, you know, after a while, wherever the Ark showed up, people afterwards started to lose their nails and their hair. Now, that only happens after radiation poisoning, or
right.
if you've been exposed to radiation poisoning. And so the question is, could it be that the Ark of the Covenant contained some type of a nuclear-driven device? And we think it did. And I totally understand how crazy that sounds, but our past is way different than what we're led to believe today, way more sophisticated than what we're being led to believe today.
Now, I want to jump across the horizon because, I mean, a lot of people become very ethnocentric, especially I notice in the Western Hemisphere. They think everything started from the Greeks or whatever. I'm sorry. but everything started from Western civilization, where the Egyptians or whatever, and they never really look into Asian societies personally, and I think that's an issue. And my curiosity, because of Taoism and mm-hmm. things that have in Asia, as far as their relation, because I saw a lot of information relating to extraterrestrial activities, the Egyptians, the Mayans, yada yada, and it seems like everything on the west side. But if you go to the east, I'm going beyond India too, because I know I read stuff about India. I don't see enough information regarding Asia, but I speculate that there's definitely got to be some significant artifacts, almost as significant as, because their society seems to have jumped up leaps and bounds from their technology and things, and their, especially their philosophy was so far ahead. Even the Sumerians are just trying to figure out how to milk goats. They were so far, it seemed like their society was way ahead. So I was just curious if there is information regarding ancient China or that it was before really China, but that society is regarding to either contact or influence or
Absolutely.
Archaeological means.
Absolutely, because, you know, whenever I think about ancient China, the first thing that comes to my mind, and you're absolutely right, it was not called China back then, but the first thing that comes to my mind are those descriptions and the figurines and the carvings that we still today can see in paintings of the dragon kings, the dragon emperors, that who descended from the sky in these fire-spewing dragons. And these dragons wreaked havoc upon the population, and they were a sign of power and things like this. And my immediate question is, well, hold on a second now. Did dragons really exist as a biological entity, as a living organism, or were dragons, in fact, nothing else but misunderstood machines or misunderstood technology? And the answer is a very likely yes, because whenever you have close descriptions about these dragons, you can always read that when these dragons descended, their skin was gleaming like metal, and they had a very rigid body, and they were always loud. And whenever they landed, the earth was trembling, and there was a lot of wind and dust and storms coming up. And then the emperors, the original emperors, who, you know, descended from the sky.
Didn't they just come out from within the clouds, too, something like that?
Yes, yes, within the clouds, but also they came out of the dragon's mouth or out of the dragon's belly.
Right.
Now, if you don't have the vocabulary to name something, what do? You circumscribe it with something, you describe it with something, with the words that were available to you at the time. And so that is where the big predicament lies, that our ancestors, again, intellectually speaking, were as intelligent as we are today, because brain function and brain volume and everything has not changed in the last, 100,000 years. So, you know, to suggest that, all our ancestors, they had nothing better to do than to sit around and invent fantasy stories, I mean, that's just, it's absolutely preposterous and insulting what mainstream science suggests today. I mean, it really is, because, our ancestors had better things to do than inventing stories, because at that time, you know, survival and finding food was of the utmost importance. So I don't think that they had enough time or enough of a, carefree life where they would just sit around a campfire, rub their hands together, get drunk, smoke dope, and say, all right, what story shall we come up with tonight? I really don't think that that's how it was.
What about, besides the dragons, is there any, like, artifacts of nature?
Well, there are, pyramids in China. One, the most famous one is called the White Pyramid, and while it is still difficult to locate any photographs,
Where is that located?
That's the problem. Nobody knows, and today it is in a military zone that is not accessible to the public.
Okay.
But there are smaller sized pyramids all around China, and so it's very interesting to see that these pyramids are not, because you see the pyramids that we find in Maya land, they're all kind of stepped pyramids, and they're pyramid-like, but they're nowhere near or nowhere similar to the pyramids in Egypt, whereas the pyramids that are found in China are very similar, although on a much smaller scale, than the ones in Egypt. So the thing is that, oh, by the way, there's also a pyramid in ancient Greece that can be found on the Peloponnese. It's not that tall, but it's very interesting. It's about 14 yards tall, but it's a
There's also pyramids in, I believe, in the eastern United States that the Native Americans have called, and, you know, I think it's near Mississippi area. They're like mounds, and now they're digging up, and they consider they're like underground mound pyramids.
Right. Absolutely. The pyramid phenomenon is worldwide, and then, you know, you were asking about other artifacts. You know, China is fascinating because, you know, their origin story talks about that a cosmic turtle arrived from the deep, dark nothingness. And deep, dark nothingness, what is that? Is that really just chaos, or could that be another description for deep space? Well, obviously, I'm leaning towards deep space. So what was that cosmic turtle? Well, was it really a turtle? Of course not, because our ancestors knew what a real turtle was. So when you read up on the descriptions of these ancient cosmic turtles, they're always described as being either made of metal or of silver, and they had this weird gleam to them, and out of the turtle, while it was hovering in the sky, a heavenly ladder was deployed, and the original emperors, the dragon kings, descended to earth on that heavenly ladder. Now, does such a thing as a heavenly ladder exist? No. Does a hovering turtle exist? Of course not. But you look at that stuff from a modern perspective and ask yourself, well, maybe they saw something technological in nature, something that was made with nuts and bolts, and boom, the answer is clear: extraterrestrials.
So it's just like the repeat thing in a different way. It's like someone who's never seen a spaceship before.
Yes.
And they describe it like it's that bird with got metal on it. You know.
Absolutely.
So they're basically describing the same thing over and over in every society, how they can describe it in their relationship. It's just like, if you read in Ezekiel, for example, he couldn't describe what the spaceship. So he's talking the thing spinning around. The extraterrestrials, he tried to describe them as having some sort of description of animal, you know, figures, but with animal faces. So how can he describe the faces when they're
dissimilar? Or that they were wearing, or that the quote unquote angels, by the way, they were called watchers, not angels at the time, and guardians,
right.
That they were described to wear these, you know, clothes that were almost like suits made of metal and
right.
gleaming like metal and
yep.
things like that. And here we are saying that all those things were nothing else but visions and figments of their imagination. And I think that is completely false.
So just to close, because we've only got so much time, a couple of minutes left, How would do you think for right now that you're basically from the beginning? You said basically you feel well, they've always been back.
Yeah.
That they're already been here, and that what do you personally think that in your opinion, based upon your things in relationship, if you can reiterate even what you feel that is, you postulate that will be happening within. You call it disclosure, but just perpetuating more disclosure or finally full contact?
Definitely more disclosure first, but I really do think that full contact will be made well within our lifetimes. I was at the Conscious Life Expo just a couple of days ago, and someone said that it will be happening in the next 3 to 4 years. I think that's too soon. I would think it would be the next 20 to 30 years because, you know, while you and I and all of our listeners might be quite excited to make contact, the bottom line is that the great majority of mankind would be absolutely freaked out about this if it were true. And it is, of course. But they would totally, you know, there might be mass panic. There really might.
Yeah, that's some, there'd be definitely... problems with a lot of people hold on to their religious convictions as well.
Yes, because, see, and here's the crazy thing, that in order to subscribe to ancient aliens, you don't have to lose your belief in God at all. In fact, it just makes God's creation even more magnificent, but it also means that, you know, God is not what we thought it was, because God, described in the Bible, was an extraterrestrial, so that, in my opinion, was not God. God is way beyond that. It's something way bigger.
Yeah. And so humanity tends to personify God. That's the problem.
That is the problem.
Yeah. No,
I'm listening to myself here now.
Yeah, it is. It is. That's the illogical thing. When you tell, even I had a scientist one time. I was talking to him, and then when he was talking science, but then he was, and I said, wait a second. But isn't, you know, looking in quantum physics, God, everything is a God, so therefore you can't personify it. But, and he goes, but in this case, and it's sort of like a, you know, oxymoron there. But anyway, I want to really, really want to thank you for coming on my show. Guy, I mean, I've seen your show many times. This book, by the way, everybody really, really needs to get it, Twilight of the Gods, Eric von Däniken. It's an inspiring book. Once you get it, people will be fighting over it. I'm just telling you, I had... So 3 months of having it, it took me fighting to get my book back. I had to get sent back from Australia. Anyway, I want to again thank you for coming on my show. How can people contact you and keep update to your events or what you're going on and more information that you'll be?
Yeah, it's very simple. You just go to legendarytimes.com. And then season 2 of Ancient Aliens begins in 6 days on the 28th of October, Thursday, on the History Channel. And I'm also on Facebook, Giorgio A. Tsoukalos. You can find me there. And it would be great if you'd all tune in for second season of Ancient Aliens. And it was a great pleasure to be in the program.
And thank you for coming on. And with that, everybody, I'm going to be closing with a little another morsel of Angie Matheson with Mississippi. Again, thank you all, and buena giornata to everyone. God bless you all, and have a glorious day and weekend. Until next time, God bless you all. Thank you.
Drifter, baby, why you gotta run? Only muse in the setting sun. Go to the end of the other direction, and the miles will be your protection. Hey, hey, let's meet up Mississippi, yeah, yeah.